This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest-running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry. I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Blair.
Want to hear something scary?
Join me as I read the creepiest urban legends, folk tales, and ghost stories that I learn on my travels around the world and that we receive from listeners like you. But only if you think you can handle it. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, sweet screams.
Due to the graphic nature of these killers' crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some of you may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
911 dispatch, what is your emergency?
She's not breathing! Oh my God, she's not breathing!
Okay, slow down, sir. What happened?
My fiance's sister, we came downstairs and heard her coughing. When we got to her room, she stopped breathing. Oh my God, Carla, do something!
Christmas Eve, 1990, 15-year-old Tammy Homolka died choking on her own vomit. Why? Her older sister Carla and her fiancé Paul had drugged her and then forced Tammy to breathe a chemical called halothane. Also, Paul could rape her. It was Carla's twisted Christmas present to her husband-to-be. He wanted to have sex with a virgin, but the night took an even darker turn when Tammy started to choke. And it was this night that would change Paul's criminal path forever.
It is very sexually stimulating to control, dominate, torture, and then kill somebody else.
In this clip you just heard, a criminologist discusses what arouses a sexual sadist and how the actual act of murder can be a part of that equation. In the mind of a serial rapist turned serial killer, it seems that both crimes go hand in hand.
For Paul Bernardo and his fiancée Carla Homolka, this would unfortunately prove to be true. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of the world's most notorious serial killers. This week, we continue our exploration into the twisted mind of Paul Bernardo, who now has a partner in crime. His fiancée, Carla Homolka. If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory or on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Don't forget to subscribe. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. Here with me is Vanessa, my criminal psychology-loving co-host. She's here to take us beyond the simple facts of Paul and Carla's story and provide us with a psychological perspective. Vanessa will be talking about the mental makeup of a serial killer, what makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like, as well as providing other valuable insight. It's important to note that she's not a licensed psychologist or a psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show.
Enough about me, Greg. Let's get back to these fascinating criminals.
Since you insist. So Paul and Carla were responsible for the horrific yet unexpected death of Carla's sister, Tammy. And it all happened while Carla's parents were asleep upstairs. So I bet you're wondering, what did they do next? Well, the two quickly snapped to action. They dressed Tammy back in her clothes and placed her on the bed. They cleared out any evidence of foul play and then called 911. When the police and paramedics arrived, it was too late. The police questioned Paul and Carla, who explained what they had told the police dispatcher, with one other detail, that they thought Tammy had been drinking and wondered if it was possible that she had too much to drink, which made her throw up. After their round of questioning, the cops believed that's exactly what had happened. Similar to a drug overdose, Tammy had imbibed too much alcohol. She most likely passed out and then started vomiting, and since she wasn't conscious, she couldn't sit up, so she choked to death. However, there was a bit of a wrinkle in the story, a valuable piece of evidence that suggested this may not be the case. On Tammy's left cheek, there is a deep red mark the size of a sand dollar, a chemical burn from the halothane-soaked rag. But authorities didn't know this, so they explained it away as a severe rug burn from when Tammy was convulsing and vomiting. No one suspected there was any foul play.
This is one of the most fascinating aspects of the serial killer phenomenon. The ones who often enact the most horrific crimes are the ones we least expect. Carla's parents adored Paul and Carla, and never in a million years would have thought the two were capable of harm like that.
Why didn't any of the authorities think to investigate this further?
This is deeply troubling and goes back to something we mentioned last week when the police questioned Paul after receiving tips that he was the Scarborough rapist, but let him go after only 35 minutes because they believed he was too intelligent and well-adjusted to commit the crimes. Again, right here, their bias led them to ignore evidence that didn't fit a common narrative. Police can have preconceptions that limit their judgment. It seems that the most feasible theory for them was that a young teenager was partying and drank way too much, which led to her death. Sadly, though, in this scenario, Tammy becomes less of a victim in their eyes and more of an irresponsible, unfortunate teenager. This is the narrative that Carla's parents and authorities found most acceptable. This is the danger anyone can fall into, believing what we want to believe, latching on to preconceptions and failing to entertain the most disturbing of possibilities.
So you're saying that even though there were strange bits of evidence, Carla's parents and the authorities believed it was an accidental death because they couldn't even entertain the alternative.
Right, which would make it easy for them to discount the red mark. The rug burn theory was an acceptable explanation in their eyes.
And I guess this explains why no tests, such as a rape kit, were done on Tammy to determine otherwise.
Yes, sounds pretty mishandled.
Hindsight, right? Following Tammy's death, Paul and Carla pretended to mourn with her family. But behind closed doors, it was another story. In bizarre and disturbing reenactments, Carla would don her sister's clothes and she and Paul would have sex on Tammy's bed.
That's not disturbing at all. It seems the death and the fact that their role in the death was a secret was a bit of a turn-on for them. It's like a very twisted version of sexual role play.
And sadly, it would only get more twisted from there. In June of 1991, Paul drove from Toronto to St. Catharines, like he had done several times before. But this time, he stopped in the town of Burlington to steal license plates. He collected plates to cover his own when he crossed the border to smuggle cigarettes. Apparently, he took precautions when it came to his illegal business. But while in Burlington, in the dead of the night, Paul came across a 14-year-old girl who had missed her curfew and was locked out of the house. Her name was Leslie Mahaffey. On the front door was a note written by her mother. It said, "You have missed curfew. Do not knock or ring the doorbell. You may sleep on the patio."
Hey, you okay?
Not really. My parents locked me out.
Paul kidnapped her and drove her to his house where Carla was waiting. He brought Leslie inside and told Carla they had a new playmate. Please be advised that the following discussions involve rape. What you're about to hear is disturbing and intended for mature audiences only. That evening, Paul and Carla tortured and sexually abused Leslie while she was still blindfolded and recorded it all like some demented home movie. Eventually, Leslie's blindfold began to slip off her eyes. No one knows for sure if she got a look at her attackers, but Carla was fearful enough that she suggested to Paul that they kill Leslie. That way, they could be sure she wouldn't be able to identify them to authorities. It seems Leslie was given a lethal dose of Halcyon, a drug used to treat insomnia. And then she was strangled by Paul.
Whatever the real cause of death, Paul and Carla murdered again that night, and this time it was fully intentional.
Next, the two dragged Leslie's body into their basement. After discussing it, they decided the best way to get rid of the evidence was to dismember the body and put the pieces in blocks of cement. The next day, Paul went to a hardware store to buy some supplies. Paul used his grandfather's saw to cut up Leslie's body, and he and Carla placed the parts in cement. Once they had accomplished part one of this operation, they drove to Lake Gibson and dropped the heavy blocks into the water. But one of the blocks weighed 200 pounds, and even with them working together, they couldn't lift it into the water, so they simply left it on the shore. Maybe this would turn out to be a mistake. Some weeks after the murder, a father and son on a fishing trip discovered the strange block that stuck out like a sore thumb. Eventually, Canadian police were called to the scene. Inside the block was the torso of Leslie Mahaffey. A search yielded the other blocks, the ones that were at the bottom of the lake, and it was the discovery of Leslie's teeth and braces that confirmed her identity.
We'll return to our story in just a moment. This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com. And now, back to serial killers.
The rape, murder, and disposal of Leslie Mahaffey occurred just a few days before Paul and Carla's wedding. On June 29th, 1991, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka tied the knot in a lavish ceremony. There's a famous picture of them from that day that can easily be found online. In the photo, Carla wears a pure white dress with long sleeves and big puffy shoulders, quite the popular style of the 90s. A massive bouquet of white roses pours from her hands. Paul wears a polished black and white tux. They're seated in a limo, hands gently clasped as they smile lovingly at the camera.
And just a few days earlier, they brutally tortured and sexually abused a teenage girl, who they then murdered and dismembered.
Exactly. How is this possible? How could two people capable of such horrific behavior just days earlier then celebrate a momentous day with family and friends, smiling like the perfect couple?
Well, it's called compartmentalization. In psychology, this is defined as a coping mechanism people use to deal with conflicting emotions or ideas. We as humans do it every day. A person may ignore the disgust he or she has for a coworker so that daily pleasantries can be exchanged. A person may suppress his or her religious beliefs in order to continue work at an abortion clinic. A cheating husband may have an intimate rendezvous with his lover, then go home to a family and express love and normalcy.
So basically, every character on Mad Men would be an example of compartmentalizing.
Exactly. Don Draper is the king of compartmentalization. Now, for serial rapists or serial killers, they compartmentalize as a means of dealing with their rather inhumane urges. It's a way to basically neutralize whatever guilt or negative feelings they may have for their actions. Simply put, it's separating the self into different boxes or compartments.
I see. So, for example, if I'm speaking as a hypothetical serial killer here, this part of me kills and derives extreme pleasure from that. But this part of me smiles and laughs and enjoys times with friends.
Exactly. It's one of the most unfathomable concepts about maladaptive individuals. For those who would never even think of taking someone's life, this idea is always so hard to comprehend. And we often ask the same question you just did. How could they do unspeakable things and then pretend like it never happened? Mm. But we have to address that it is a natural human response to compartmentalize. Serial killers just do it on a much larger scale and a much deeper level. And the things they're putting in various boxes are much more disturbing than those of the average person.
Well said. So, after the joyous wedding, Paul and Carla embarked on a honeymoon in Hawaii. They were officially married. But something else had become official. They were now partners in crime. In April of 1992, they would, now as a team, go in search of their next victim. It was the Thursday before Easter Sunday. As they passed a Catholic high school in the town of St. Catharines, they decided on a target. 15-year-old Kristen French. She was walking home from school. Paul pulled the car into a church parking lot, and Carla quickly emerged. She was carrying a map.
Hi, excuse me. Can you help me? I'm trying to get to Grimsby. Do you know where that is?
While Carla distracted Kristen with the map, Paul attacked from behind, and the two abducted her.
It seems that the duo had just established their criminal game plan. Carla would serve as bait, and Paul would strike. Quite a different setup than Paul was used to.
They took Kristen to their house and treated her much like they had Leslie. Torture. Rape. They also forced her to drink tons of alcohol in order to be more submissive to Paul. And of course, they videotaped it all. One difference between this crime and the one against Leslie, Kristen was never blindfolded. So it would seem that Paul and Carla intended to kill her from the start.
Wow. It seems like every crime they commit escalates into further horror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you'll recall, the first crime Paul and Carla committed together was the rape of Carla's younger sister, Tammy, while she was drugged and unconscious. But they didn't intend to kill her. That was an accident. Now, Paul and Carla had added to their criminal narrative. Not only were they raping, they were also torturing their victims while they're conscious and then killing them. This is a big leap in the severity of their crimes.
Yes, I completely agree.
What could account for this?
Well, you know the old saying, two heads are better than one, right? Mm. That when two people get together, it's easier to come up with a solution or idea. But I think in this case, in addition to thinking up better abduction tactics, having a partner in crime allowed Paul the freedom to expand his darkest desires and elevate his crimes in severity. Having Carla there with him gave him a confidence boost to inflict more pain and do more damage. Basically, it was like, the sky's the limit now.
That makes a lot of sense.
A clinical psychologist at the University of Nevada, Reno, actually discussed this very topic in regards to a serial rapist back in 2008.
Yes, and we have that recording here. This is Dr. William O'Donohue.
Often sexual murderers and sexual sadists have behavioral rehearsals or behavioral tryouts where they engage in some of the acts that they're interested in, and then they escalate to the level of intensity that they're most interested in.
So Dr. O'Donohue alluded to a trial period in which serial rapists start out with certain behaviors. Then once they feel more comfortable and have found what really stimulates them, they escalate to more and more intense actions. But we have to address that it was Carla's presence in his criminal life that helped spur this on. Greg McCrary, the behavioral criminologist who worked on this very investigation, commented on this in regards to Paul and Carla. Here is a direct quote from him. Quote, "Predators are like sharks, waiting to see who will swim by and take the bait. If the other person reacts badly, it's easy to shrug the incident off as a joke. When they find one who responds the way they're hoping, they think, this is someone who can do this with me. They might say, what would you think if I were a rapist? If the person thinks it's cool, they can take their next step."
And in this case, the next step was murder, an aspect that must have excited Paul. And it became part of his and Carla's criminal story.
Exactly right. The other concept that might be interesting to explore is the dynamic of a married couple bringing a third party into their twisted sex game. Mm. We have to look at the fact that the two are married at this point, and yet they are raping and killing together. This means that Carla's husband is sleeping with other women while they are married. Yes, she is a part of it, but there is a fundamental underlying fact. Carla is not enough for Paul. His needs go beyond what she's capable of fulfilling. I think she's always known this. It's why she offered her sister's virginity as a Christmas present, and it's why she encouraged his sexual sadism. And she didn't want to lose him. She had become so emotionally and psychologically dependent on him. So we have to imagine that Carla's abuse of her own sister must have fulfilled a need to get back at Tammy for being the object of Paul's desire.
What do you mean?
Well, we all know that women are inherently competitive with each other.
High school is proof enough of that.
That's the truth. And women can easily feel jealousy and resentment toward another woman if a man is involved. Remember the story about the female astronaut who drove across the country to try to kill her ex-boyfriend's current girlfriend?
How could I forget? That was absolutely bizarre. And the detail I remember the most is that the woman was so hell-bent on getting revenge, she didn't even stop to go to the bathroom.
That's right. She wore diapers so she could drive straight there. Now, of course, this is an extreme example, but it happens. So for Carla, I think that part of the reason she became his accomplice was that she needed an outlet for this jealousy. It was one way for her to release her frustrations about Paul's desire for other women. I believe that her helping abduct, torture, and then kill these young women was cathartic for her. If she can't have Paul's full attention, she can at least help him get what he wants and destroy in the process those who steal that attention.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's not sane, but it sheds light on her motivation for sure. We actually have a clip from one of Carla's police interrogations in which she alludes to this jealousy. In it, Carla tells investigators that after Paul brought Kristen French home, Carla was enraged because Paul served Kristen champagne in glasses they had gotten for their wedding. It's quite bizarre. Take a listen.
Oh, and I was really mad too because when I took Buddy out, there were two champagne glasses on the dining room table. And we had these really expensive champagne glasses from France, which we never used. He had those out. The two of them had been drinking champagne from those glasses. And I was really mad.
What really strikes me about this is the fact that Carla fixates on the detail that Paul let Kristen drink out of the fancy glasses. This just proves that Carla has this ongoing inferiority complex when it came to other women and Paul. And she was so self-centered that she didn't even acknowledge that she was in a much better position than Kristen because Kristen was the one who would become the victim of such an atrocious crime.
Right. Carla's thinking is so backwards here.
Yes, and I'm sure a lot of this was subconscious for Carla. It's apparent to me that she was so disconnected and lacking in self-awareness. We can look at another concept to better understand the psychology of this competition aspect. I'm sure you've heard of monogamous couples suddenly deciding to try ménage à trois, or as it's more commonly known in America, a threesome.
Well, couples usually do this to spice up their sex life, right?
Right. And it probably works great for some people. But more often than not, bringing a third person into the bedroom creates jealousy, insecurity, and conflict. And I think there's a similar thing happening here. Carla's insecurity pushes her to harm these girls because she's basically jealous of them. Yet she would never do the one thing that would solve her problem, leave Paul and find a man who doesn't need other women to feel satisfied.
Exactly. Instead of leaving Paul, she helped him murder their third victim. The two killed Kristen French just hours before they went to Easter dinner at the Homolka house. They tied a cord around her neck and strangled her like they did Leslie. Kristen's naked body was found 2 weeks later. She had been thrown into a ditch in Burlington, a town 45 minutes from St. Catharines. And oddly enough, the body dump was made nearby the cemetery where Paul and Carla's previous victim, Leslie Mahaffey, was buried. Following the discovery of Kristen's body, Canadian authorities attributed the two deaths to a new criminal, the schoolgirl killer. But when police drafted up a report which included a criminal profile, they stated the following: rapists, identified as sexual sadists, are statistically less than 2% of all these types of offenders. There's a high probability that the Scarborough rapist and the sexually sadistic murderer of Mahaffey and French is the same offender.
So the authorities were on the right track, but sadly, opportunities to catch their killers would slip through their fingers.
One of those very opportunities happened right around the time of Kristen's abduction. Paul, an avid stalker, went driving one day to scam on some local teens. He set his sights on two sisters, Carrie and Shanna Patrick.
Mrs. Holland is such a drag.
She really is.
She's just so mean.
What'd she do this time?
She wouldn't give me a hall pass. I told her I had to go to the bathroom, but...
Wait. Look, what's he doing?
Who?
Right behind us. Is he following us?
He's looking right at us.
And driving way too slow. Here, turn at this corner.
Oh my god, he has a freaking camera.
Hurry up, we're almost home.
What a sicko.
You have a notebook?
Yeah.
Get it out. We'll write down his license plate. Hurry.
Here. Did you get it?
I think so.
But in her rushing, Carrie accidentally wrote down the wrong plate number. She then phoned police and was given an incident number, but nothing came of it. About 2 weeks later, however, Carrie spotted Paul while he was out grabbing dinner at a movie rental. This was the same night that Kristen French was holed up in Paul and Carla's house. Carrie tried to track him to his house, but she lost him. She did get a better look at the license plate, though, and this time reported it correctly to the police. But sadly, the information was mishandled and got lost in the shuffle. This was another mistake made by the authorities, and possibly one of the reasons it took them a while to find Paul. But in the end, it would be a delayed lab test and a lover's quarrel that would lead to the demise of the Ken and Barbie killers. On January 5th, 1993, all was not blissful between the murderous couple. They had gotten into an argument, and in his rage, Paul brutally beat Carla with a flashlight. She was left with severe bruises on her legs and big black circles under her eyes. When she arrived to work at the vet clinic, her co-workers noticed the bruises and asked her about it. Carla told them she'd been in a car accident. No one was buying it. A co-worker called her parents, who took her to the hospital. There she admitted the truth of what happened. Paul had beaten her. And this wasn't the first time. She was living with an abusive husband. So Carla went to live with her aunt and uncle. She eventually confessed to them that Paul was the Scarborough rapist and the killer of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French. She just left out one minor detail, that she was also involved in those two slayings.
Well, she had the battered wife card to play.
After Carla's admission, her relatives alerted police. And this is where it all collided.
Our story will continue in a moment after the break. Now the story continues.
Around the same time that Carla's relatives came forth with information, the lab, which had been backlogged with hundreds of DNA samples, finally got to Paul's. And guess what? It was a positive match for the Scarborough rapist. Paul was arrested and interrogated by police. Considering Carla's statement, the DNA evidence, and witness details linking him to the abduction of Kristen French, authorities already had strong evidence against him.
I'll ask you again. Are you responsible for the deaths of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French?
No, I am not. I will admit to assaulting them, but Carla did the killing. I didn't want to kill them.
You're saying you sexually assaulted both Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French, but Carla Homolka, your wife, carried out their murders?
Yes.
After this, Carla contacted a lawyer and decided to speak as a witness against Paul. The newlyweds had been torn asunder by the threat of imprisonment. Now they were only looking out for themselves. It seems that Carla was very quick to turn on Paul. What can explain that? Simply the fear of going to jail?
Yes, that, but I think it's more than that. Paul's very brutal beating of her set the stage. Then, when Paul accused her of being the real mastermind, I think she realized she had been used in a way. She was finally able to see that he never truly cared about her. It was all about power and control for him, and that he actually brought her into his dark world. However, we can't ignore the fact that she went along with everything and eventually suggested they kill their victims. Paul may have sucked her into his world, but she was a willing participant.
That's right. But she didn't admit that at first. In her interrogation with police, she completely blamed Paul for everything.
Her feet were tied with that electrical cord that he had used to kill Leslie. And there was electrical cord around her neck.
She also told police that she felt trapped because he could hurt her and because she loved him. When they first met, he had treated her like a princess, and he wasn't boring like the other men she knew at the time. When asked how she felt about him now, Carla said she hoped he'd rot in prison.
Well, a court would decide if that would be the case. Carla accepted a plea deal of 12 years in prison for manslaughter, while Paul was tried for sexual assault and murder. You may wonder how this is possible. Carla was at the very least half responsible for the murders of Leslie and Kristen. In fact, it may have even been her suggestion to start killing the rape victims in the first place. The reason she got off so easily? The answer lies in the actions of Paul's lawyer, Ken Murray. He had confiscated Paul and Carla's home videos, the ones that documented all their crimes. On them was damning evidence against them both. Mr. Murray kept the tapes, and so they were never considered evidence in the trial.
That's horrible.
The tapes did eventually surface after the trial, but in 2001, a judge ordered that they be destroyed. They were incinerated with the other evidence from the trial as a way to pay homage to the victims and their families, who feared the tapes would someday make it on the internet. Mr. Murray was charged with obstruction of justice in 1997, but in the end, he was acquitted. And so Carla got her plea bargain of 12 years for manslaughter, hardly enough to match the crimes on those tapes. In fact, years later, a judicial committee admitted that Carla would never have been offered a plea bargain had the tapes been taken into consideration. But at the time of Paul's trial, Carla presented herself to be just as much a victim as those young girls.
She was good at playing whatever part she needed to in order to save her own skin. This was evident in her trial testimony.
How would you describe Paul's demeanor during these attacks?
Happy.
He was happy?
Yes, he was a happy rapist. He loved to hurt women.
Miss Homolka, I'm holding in my hand a Xerox copy of a page from your diary. It says, "Be a perfect girlfriend for Paul. Remember you're stupid. Remember you're ugly. Remember you're fat. Save yourself. Kill them all." Can you explain this entry?
I was afraid of him, so I wanted to remind myself of what I had to do so that he wouldn't hurt me.
This last part, "save yourself, kill them all." What is this referring to?
I didn't want him to kill me, so I did whatever he asked.
Did you help kill Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French?
No.
So the "kill them all" statement, how do you explain that?
I wrote it down to convince myself just how much danger I was in.
Sort of a better them than me?
Yes.
So you let him kill them?
I didn't stop him, no.
But you didn't lift a hand against them?
No.
This was obviously a bold-faced lie.
However, it worked. And it was Paul who got the short end of the stick. Or perhaps exactly what he deserved. On September 1st, 1995, he was convicted of 2 first-degree murders and 2 aggravated sexual assaults. He was sentenced to life in prison. On top of that, he was named a dangerous offender, which is like a black mark in Canada, and it would make his chances for parole very slim.
Was the death penalty an option?
No, actually. Canada abolished the death penalty in 1976. Several newspaper headlines declared the result of the trial. The Saturday Sun featured a picture of Paul behind bars in a transport vehicle. On their front page, written in big bold letters, was, "Rot in hell, you bastard."
Wow. But what about the death of Tammy, Carla's sister?
Well, at this point, her death was still considered an accident. It wasn't until much later that her death was deemed a murder.
How did that happen?
Considering the murders of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French, authorities went back to investigate Tammy's death. Her body was removed from the grave and examined.
Wow. If only they had examined it back in 1990.
I know. And it makes you think that maybe the deaths of Leslie and Kristen may have been prevented if Paul and Carla had been found responsible for Tammy's. But who knows? As for Paul's other crimes, all those rapes prior to his joining up with Carla, those are attributed to him as well, but weren't part of the trial. And there are other assaults and deaths that haven't been confirmed. The list is long, but I'll only mention a few. When police searched Paul's house after his arrest in 1993, they found a newspaper clipping that described a rape in Hawaii. You may recall that Paul and Carla went to Hawaii for their honeymoon. Well, the date of the rape matched the week they were there for vacation. Many believe Paul, and possibly Carla too, were responsible for this attack, but the case was never taken to court. There is also a victim referred to by Paul as January Girl, who he abducted and raped. Then there is a 14-year-old girl, a high school rower, who Paul most likely attacked and raped in the bushes near her school's rowing club. Then there are numerous cases of stalkings, including the Patrick sisters, which I mentioned earlier. And that brings us to the murder of Elizabeth Bain. She had been killed back in the early 90s, but her case was still unsolved. In June of 2007, at the Kingston Penitentiary in Kingston, Ontario, Paul gave a recorded interview to authorities. The purpose of the interview? He was being investigated as a suspect in Elizabeth's murder.
Did you kill Elizabeth Bain on June the 19th, 1990?
Well, it's a loaded question. I mean, are we going to go back and go through the time sequence of what happened in my life? I mean, I could just give a yes or no answer, but you know, there's a lot of issues about that.
Leave it to Paul to not answer a question directly. Does this man still think that he can manipulate his way out of a situation? Or maybe he's just in denial of who he really is and what he's really done. The problem is, we'll never really know.
Paul Bernardo is currently living in an 8x4-foot cell in the segregation unit of a maximum security prison. This was done for his protection. But even separating Paul from the other inmates couldn't keep him completely safe from the others inside. In 1999, a group of inmates stormed the segregation wing in an attempt to gain access to Paul. A riot squad was eventually called to the scene. The inmates' attempt wasn't exactly a success, but it sent a strong signal. Vanessa, what do you think it was about Paul that caused such an uproar?
That's easy, Greg. The nature of his crimes. It's very common for other inmates to target child molesters, rapists, or child murderers.
And Paul was all of the above.
I'm sure his fellow inmates wanted to destroy him. Oddly enough, there's a certain code of ethics that most criminals follow. And one of the big no-nos is don't rape and kill young girls.
That would explain why he was punched in the face one day while returning from the showers. But it wasn't all bad for Paul while he was locked up. Somehow he managed to ensnare a new woman while behind bars. In 2014, Paul became engaged to a 30-year-old mystery woman. Paul was 50 at the time. She gave an interview to the Toronto Sun, explaining that she had been writing letters to Paul for years and told her friends she believed he was innocent. In a direct quote, she even said, "He is a kind man," unquote. At the time of the interview, she had a new tattoo on her ankle. It read, "Paul's girl," in fancy cursive. The two didn't end up tying the knot, but she sounds like another serial killer groupie.
I agree. In cases like these, a woman may have the delusion that the criminal is actually innocent, or she may believe she is the only person capable of changing the heart of a murderer. Sometimes it gives a woman a sense of power or authority in society to be involved with a high-profile criminal. Whatever the reason, it's not mentally sound at all.
But it can go the other way, too. Men can be attracted to women who have been convicted of vicious crimes. In fact, that was just the case with Carla and her husband, Thierry Bordelais. He's the brother of Carla's former lawyer. When Carla was released in 2005, she and Thierry married and moved to a secluded island in the Caribbean, where they had three children together. But in 2016, she resurfaced in Chateauguay, a suburb of Quebec. However, a reporter from La Presse announced her appearance, which outraged residents. No one wanted a convicted serial killer in their neighborhood.
I don't blame them.
As for Paul, he is up for parole this year. But the lawyer representing the two families of victims Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French said he was confident Paul would never get parole. And there you have it. The man known as both the Scarborough rapist and the schoolgirl killer could potentially go free this year and join his former partner in crime out in the real world.
Honestly, Greg, knowing that Carla is now living a normal life and that it soon may be possible for Paul, I'm almost beside myself. Mm. Thinking back on the despicable, almost demonic crimes they committed, I'm shocked by how such a thing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
When I read or hear about them, they will always remain, in my eyes, the Ken and Barbie killers. And that's as close to human as they'll ever be.
Thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Be sure to join us next Monday as we start investigating the psychological profile of Ted Bundy. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. Have a killer week?
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Jessica Mallow and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Austin, Mike Capozzi, Z. Cruz, Nicholas Massu, and Manu Narayan.